Stalin remained on holiday, directing a series of parallel tragedies in his escalating campaign to eliminate his enemies. The former Politburo member and editor of Izvestia, Bukharin, was hill-climbing in the Pamirs when he read in the newspapers that he had been implicated in the Zinoviev trial. He frantically rushed back to Moscow. On the 8th of September, the Central Committee summoned Bukharin to a meeting with Kaganovich, where, along with Yezhov and Vyshinsky, he was amazed to encounter his childhood friend, Grigory Sokolnikov, a venerable old Bolshevik, who was delivered to the room by the NKVD. The confrontation was one of Stalin's bizarre rituals in which, like an exorcism, good was meant to confront and vanquish evil. They were presumably designed to terrify the accused and convince the presiding Politburo members of the victim's guilt. Sokolnikov declared there was a left-right center involving Bukharin, which was planning the murder of Stalin. "Can you have lost your reason and not be responsible for your own words?" cried Bukharin. Kaganovich boomed. "Sokolnikov is lying, the whore, from beginning to end. Go back to the newspaper, Nikolai Ivanovich, and work in peace." The unconvinced Kaganovich still adored Bukharin, but told Stalin his role will yet be uncovered. Stalin's antennae sensed that the time was not right. Vyshinsky announced that the investigation against Bukharin and Rykov had been closed due to lack of criminal culpability. Bukharin returned to work, safe again, while the investigators moved on to their next trial. But the cat did not stop caressing the mouse. Gradually, instructing Kaganovich in political and Yezhov in security matters by telephone from Sochi, Stalin presided over the effective NKVD takeover of the Republic itself, where he found himself in a genuine struggle with the Trotskyites. He was joined in Sochi by Zhdanov and President Kalinin. Yezhov was expanding the lists of suspects to include not only the whole of the old oppositions, but also entire nationalities, particularly the Poles. Simultaneously, he was pushing for the role of NKVD chief, attacking Yagoda for complacency, passivity, and bragging. Meanwhile, Yagoda bugged Yezhov's calls to Stalin, learning that Blackberry had been summoned to Sochi. Yagoda left immediately for Sochi, but when he arrived, was turned back from the gates of Stalin's dacha. On the 25th of September, Stalin, backed by Zhdanov, decided to remove Yagoda and promote Yezhov. There was relief at Yezhov's appointment. Many, including Bukharin, regarded it as the end of the terror, not the beginning. But Kaganovich knew his protégé better. He praised Yezhov's superb interrogations to Stalin, suggesting his promotion to Commissar General. The dwarfish Blackberry was now the second most powerful man in the USSR. Stalin was deeply dissatisfied with the sickness inside the NKVD, which he rightly regarded as the ultimate Bolshevik old boy network, filled with dubious Poles, Jews, and Letts. He needed an outsider to get control of this self-satisfied elite and make it his own. He had recently offered the job of running the NKVD to Lakoba, but Lakoba refused to move to Moscow. Loyal as he was to Stalin, Lakoba was better suited to playing the magnanimous host in the resorts of Abkhazia than torturing innocents in the cellars of the Lubyanka. His refusal drew attention to the rule of his clan in Abkhazia, known as Lakobistan, which he wanted to be made into a full Soviet republic, a dangerous idea in the fragile multinational USSR. Beria invited Lakoba to dinner in Tiflis. He refused until Beria's mother telephoned to insist. They dined and then went to the theater, where Lakoba was overcome with nausea. Returning to his hotel, he sat by the window, groaning. "That snake Beria has killed me." At 4:20 a.m., Lakoba died of a heart attack, aged 43. Denounced as an enemy of the people, his family were also killed. Stalin had given Beria carte blanche to settle scores in the Caucasus. In Armenia, Beria visited the first secretary, Agassi Hanchan, who either killed himself or was murdered. Across the Imperium, the regions began to expose conspiracies of wreckers to justify inefficiencies and corruption. The clock was ticking towards war with Hitler's Germany, but as tension was mounting with aggressive Japan in the Far East and Soviet advisers fought in Spain, the USSR was already at war. Beria arrested Papulia Argenikitsa, Sergo's elder brother, a railway official. Beria knew that his former patron, Sergo, had warned Stalin that he was a scoundrel. Sergo refused to shake hands with Beria and built a special fence between their dachas. Beria's vengeance was just one of the ways in which Stalin began to turn the heat on to the emotional Sergo, the industrial magnifico who supported the regime's draconian policies but resisted the arrest of his own managers. The star of the next show trial was to be Sergo's deputy commissar, Yuri Pietakov, an ex-Trotskyite. In July, Pietakov's wife had been arrested for her links to Trotsky. Yezhov summoned Pietakov, read him all the affidavits implicating him in Trotskyite terrorism, and informed him that he was relieved of his job as deputy commissar. Pietakov offered to prove his innocence by asking to be allowed to shoot his wife if she were sentenced. On the 12th of September, Pietakov was arrested. Sergo, recuperating from a heart attack, voted for Pietakov's expulsion from the Central Committee, but he must have been deeply worried. Sergo appealed to Stalin on behalf of his brother. He did too much. The arrest of a man's clan was a test of loyalty. Stalin was not alone in taking a dim view of this bourgeois emotionalism. Molotov himself attacked Sergo for being guided only by emotions, thinking only of himself. On the 9th of November, Sergo suffered another heart attack. Meanwhile, another Argenikitsa brother, Veliko, was sacked from his job in the Tiflis Soviet for claiming that Papulia was innocent. Sergo swallowed his pride and called Beria, who replied, "Dear Comrade Sergo, after your call, I quickly summoned Veliko. Today, Veliko was restored to his job. Yours, L. Beria." This bears the paw prints of Stalin's cat-and-mouse game, his supersensitive testing of limits. But Stalin now regarded Sergo as an enemy, who, however, remained a living restraint on Stalin, making brave little gestures towards the beleaguered rightists. "My dear, kind, warmly blessed Sergo," encouraged Bukharin, "stand firm." At the theatre, when Stalin and the Politburo filed into the front seats, Sergo spotted ex-Premier Rykov and his daughter Natalia, alone and ignored, 20 rows up the auditorium. Leaving Stalin, Sergo galloped up to kiss them. The Rykovs were moved to tears in gratitude. At the 7th of November parade, Stalin, on the mausoleum, spotted Bukharin in an ordinary seat and sent a Chekist to say, "Comrade Stalin has invited you on to the mausoleum." Bukharin thought he was being arrested, but then, gratefully, climbed the steps. Bukharin, an enchanting but hysterical intellectual whom everyone adored, bombarded Stalin with increasingly frantic letters through which we can feel the screw tightening. "Big child," Stalin scribbled across one letter, "crank" on another. Bukharin could not stop appealing to Stalin. "Everything connected with me is criticized," he wrote. "Even for the birthday of Sergo, they did not propose me to write an article. Maybe I'm not honorable. To whom can I go, as a beloved person, without expecting a smash in the teeth? I see your intention, but I write to you as I wrote to Lenin, as a really beloved man whom I even see in dreams. Maybe it's strange, but it's so. It's hard for me to live under suspicion, and my nerves are already on edge." Bukharin's other old friend was Klim Voroshilov. The two had been so close that Bukharin called him his honey seagull, and even wrote his speeches for him. Now in real danger, Bukharin wrote a long plea to Klim. "Forgive this confused letter. A thousand thoughts are rushing around inside my head like strong horses, and I have no strong reins. I embrace you because I am clean. and Bukharin. Voroshilov decided he had to end this ghost of a friendship, so he ordered his adjutant to copy the letter to the Politburo and write, "I enclose herewith, on Comrade Voroshilov's orders, Comrade Voroshilov's reply to Bukharin." The reply was a study in amorality, cruelty, fear, and cowardice. "To Comrade Bukharin, I return your letter in which you permit yourself to make vile attacks on the party leadership. If you were hoping to convince me of your complete innocence, all you have convinced me of is that henceforth I should distance myself from you. And if you do not repudiate in writing your foul epithets against the party leadership, I shall even regard you as a scoundrel. K. Voroshilov." Bukharin was heartbroken. "My letter ended with, 'I embrace you.' Your letter ends with, 'Scoundrel.'" Yezhov was creating the case against the so-called leftists, Radek and Pietakov, but he also managed to procure evidence against Bukharin and Rykov. The December plenum was a sort of arraignment of these victims and, as always with Stalin, a test of the conditions necessary to destroy them. Stalin was the dominant will, but the terror was not the work of one man. Stalin, assisted by Yezhov, shaped the febrile fears of war with Poland and Germany and the very real dangers of the Spanish Civil War, the inexplicable industrial failures caused by Soviet incompetence, and the resistance of the regional princes into a web of conspiracies that dovetailed with the paranoic soul and glorious, nostalgic brutality of the Russian Civil War and personal feuds of the Bolsheviks. Stalin was particularly suspicious of the infiltration of spies across the porous border with Poland, traditional enemy of Russia's western marches that had defeated Russia and Stalin personally in 1920. At the plenum, Khrushchev was denounced as a secret Pole. Stalin walked over, pushing a finger into Khrushchev's shoulder. "What's your name?" "Comrade Stalin, it's Khrushchev." "No, you're not Khrushchev. So-and-so says you're not." "How can you believe that? My mother's still alive. Check!" Stalin let it pass, but he was checking those around him.